Welcome to ESIP's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to Alan Beattie. Alan Beattie is a journalist and writer for the Financial Times. He was previously the International Economy and World Trade Editor for the FT. Now he is based in Brussels and covers, among other things, trade policy, the global economy and Brexit for the newspaper's editorial section and its brand new free trade newsletter. Alan is an associate fellow at the Chatham House in London and the author of the highly praised book False Economy, a fascinating account of the mysteries of the economy and economic history. I'm going to talk to Alan about trade and all the frictions we have in global trade policy right now, starting with recent developments in the US-China standoff. Alan, welcome to ESIP's Global Economy Podcast.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be here.
So, Alan, I want to start this podcast talking about US-China trade relations. We've had some developments this week with United States yet again raising tariffs, or at least saying they're going to raise tariffs on imports from China, and China retaliating against the United States. I don't know about you, but I'm beginning to be a little bit confused. I mean, like everything in Trump world, it's difficult to understand what's going on and to separate the noise from the signal. What I want to talk about here is what you think it is that the administration is trying to achieve. We hear talks about the trade deficit, that they want to fix the trade deficit. We hear talks about Huawei, or sort of a technology race, and the United States want to block China's ability to be a competitor in new technology in future. We hear about the Belt and Road and lots of other things. So what is it that the administration is trying to achieve here? And do you think it actually can achieve it?
To be honest, I'm not sure there is one thing you can point at, or even a range of consistent things you can point at, not least because you have a huge range of different views within the administration. So whatever the president thinks, you will then have a sort of range of positions from Larry Kudlow, who's kind of on the instinctively free trade side, to just Stephen Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, who follows the sort of traditional Treasury line, which is generally free trade except if it's financial services. And then Bob Lighthizer, the USTR, who's obviously the most influential individual, who's a sort of old school mercantilist, would like to take us back to the 1980s. And then all the way over to Peter Navarro, who's just a crazed, China warrior. So I think the combination of Trump himself not necessarily knowing what he wants, and I'll talk about that in a bit, but once he sets a process going, because he has famously short attention span, it will then be picked up by someone else. And it might be quite random who it is. And so even if there is an overall strategy from Trump, it doesn't really translate into that, you know, when it comes into a particular set of talks. To give you an example, I know we're about to talk about China, but when the US forced the EU to the negotiating table last year with threats of tariffs, there was a sense, everyone sort of believed that the US just wanted to put the tariffs on, and they weren't really serious about negotiating. And suddenly it turned out that Larry Kudlow, the president's economic advisor, was in charge of the talks, and because he's instinctively a free trader, suddenly the talks were going. Had someone else been in charge of it, something else might have happened. I think it really is as random as that. In terms of Trump, I mean, he himself is clearly very confused, and I think there's been an awful lot of attempts by people who understand a lot more than he does to discern some kind of overall strategy, which I just don't think is there. You know, until last week, maybe until the weekend, one belief that a lot of people had, you know, including me, was that he really, really cared about the US stock market, because he saw that as symbolic of the economy, and he thought that was the thing that was going to get him elected. And then he ramps up the aggression against China, stocks fall, and nonetheless, he continues with the aggression against China. So it's clear he's not just motivated by the stock market. He does appear to be motivated by the trade deficit, but you know, this is something he comes and goes. Sometimes he talks about it, sometimes he doesn't. I honestly think the clearest explanations that people close to him has given is he likes tariffs. He likes them. He likes the idea of them. You know, he thinks they're intrinsically an expression of power. It is the same as winning a business deal if you put tariffs on your opponents, which is why he's reluctant to raise them. And I'm afraid I don't have a clearer explanation than that, because I just don't think there is one.
No, you may be absolutely right. I mean, I think you are right. But that also leads to the question, so if they don't really know what it is they want to achieve, it's very difficult to sort of figure out what the prospects are for actually achieving something in sort of in the negotiations they're having with China right now. So going to these negotiations, I mean, we've been hearing lots of different stories coming out over the last couple of months saying that they're getting very close to achieving something, others saying that they're still sort of pretty far away from each other. What's your thinking around here? Even if they don't have a strategy from the US side, can there actually be some type of agreement between United States and China which is going to sort of take down these tariffs that were imposed and reduce the overall amount of friction?
It depends what part of the package that the US is pressing that they're prepared to accept and which they're prepared to jettison, right? So part of what they're asking for is sort of straight up managed trade, you will buy X million tons of soybeans. Now that appeals to Trump's, you know, very simplistic desire to get the bilateral trade deficit down. And if we're only a question of that, I think that'll be fine. I think China will be able to be happy to do that. The bit that's much harder is the bit that Lighthizer wants, which is genuinely a fundamental re-engineering of China's entire growth strategy to the extent that it's dependent on 5P theft, cyber theft, extensive use of subsidies and so forth. Now, that's even if China wanted to do that, it's extremely difficult to monitor and to set benchmarks that you can actually hold China to and that you could, you know, have dispute settlement over. So I think part of it is that even if there were the will, and I don't really think there is from the Chinese side, it's just technically extremely difficult to write an agreement which would adhere to that. So I think there's a combination there of, again, different people in the administration wanting different things, and some of them just simply being much easier to achieve and to solidify than others.
And your analysis about people in the administration wanting different things when it comes to China, will you say that also apply to United States policy vis-a-vis other trade issues? Take, for example, the World Trade Organization and the difficulties they're having in Geneva around the dispute settlement mechanism and finding a way to appoint new judges and, in the longer term, trying to put some new oxygen into the entire WTO system. So yet again, we have an administration who, on the one hand, seems to want to place a bomb under the entire world trading system and blow it up. And then you have other voices sort of being a bit more moderate, but still not being very friendly towards the entire WTO system. What would you say is the core message of the Americans, right, when they come to the WTO? Do they want to blow it up, or will they just want to sort of keep it down and keep it inconsequential?
This again depends on who you ask. And also in this one, it's more complicated because the WTO is such a technical, complex issue. It's a lot harder to get your head around the composition of the appellate body and the idea of judicial overreach and so forth than it is soybean purchases. So I think policy here tends to be driven much more by people like Lighthizer, who have long-standing beefs with the WTO and, you know, with the WTO's famous persistent overruling of the US's use of trade defense, of anti-dumping and countervailing duties and so forth. Now, one of the interesting things here is that ever since the US started this thing about the WTO, they've almost studiously avoided saying what they want or specifically saying what they want. You know, they forced the issue by refusing to appoint new members to the appellate body. So there's obviously a sense of crisis and of a deadline toward the end of this year when the appellate body just won't be able to make rulings. And then there's now this cottage industry, actually, it's turning into quite a large-scale industry, of different countries or groups of countries coming up with plans to change the appellate body to reform the WTO more generally, to each of which the US says no. To the extent that you can actually work out what they want, there seems to be sort of two slight strains of thought, and I wouldn't say they're embodied in different people, but one that I've heard Dennis Shea, who's the ambassador to the WTO, say, is that the dispute settlement system, the appellate body, was designed back in 1995 just to be quite a minimal way of sorting disputes, and it was not supposed to be sort of big overreaching court. Now, the sense I get, maybe not explicitly, the sense I get from that line is they'd be quite happy to start again in 1995 and have the current system, but just with a lot more judicial parsimony or constriction of what it's actually prepared to rule on. However, Lighthizer is clearly a guy from the 1980s, which is when he worked in the US administration and the Reagan administration. And he really likes that system where you don't have binding dispute settlement. Everything is essentially sorted out by bilateral diplomacy, which means essentially relative shows of strength. Now, one thing I've always wondered is that a lot of this focus from other countries on the appellate body has focused on reform of the appellate body itself. I don't think that's ever going to work. I think that's a technocratic solution to a political problem. I think what might work, very difficult though it is to give the dispute settlement system more to work with. As in, if you come up with new rules that will constrain China's subsidies and interventions and so forth, I think that a lot of the US opposition to the way the dispute settlement system works might actually melt away. In other words, they've already been aggressive and very successful users of dispute settlement. If you then gave them a whole bunch of rules that they could go after China's model with through the WTO, I think they'd be a lot happier with it. Of course, that will require getting China to accept, which is very tricky. But I think that probably is the way forward if you actually want them to let up on pushing the WTO into irrelevance.
Let's move on a little bit to Europe now. Europe, of course, is confronted by the United States as well. And we heard the rumors coming out yesterday that the tariffs that have been, if not planned, so at least discussed about imposing tariffs on automotive export from Europe to the United States, they have been postponed for 6 months. We don't know what's going to happen there. But it's obvious that looking towards the future, that Europe's relation with America will be one of the main issues for EU trade policy in the future. However, it also seems that Europe is beginning to have second thoughts about its relations with China. And regardless of what issue that comes up in Brussels these days in commercial affairs, whether it's trade policy, industrial policy, you're going to hear China, 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 China. So what is it that Europe is doing towards China? And can it actually be more successful in its approach than the United States?
Well, the EU has to triangulate carefully between the US and China. Partly, I think, just because it tends to be more cautious anyway, and of course it doesn't have this very aggressive attitude that Trump does. And also because there are specific lobbies in the EU, and car makers is one of them, who often have a disproportionate influence. So when the EU was being threatened with car tariffs last summer, that's what brought the EU to the table to negotiate. At the same time, as you say, at the same time, traditionally the EU has been much closer to China. Germany, one of the biggest trading partners with China. And there have been a lot of people sort of prepared to stand up for China trade within the EU, and indeed vis-a-vis the US. That has shifted quite markedly over the past couple of years, partly because of the Chinese penetration of the European market and Chinese takeovers in the European market, but also because European companies have just got sick of the way that they say they are being treated in China, with forced technology transfer and various forms of expropriation and so forth. So the EU, in its sort of slightly understated, less confrontational way, has moved towards giving itself more tools to take on China or to channel its economic engagement with China, such as a system of screening investments before they come in. And they've talked about using different kinds of trade defense tools to keep China out. And of course, of the issue about Huawei and the admission of Huawei to 5G systems in the EU. Now, one of the reasons the EU finds it difficult to respond collectively is a lot of these issues are determined at member state level. So foreign direct investment, overwhelmingly a member state issue. Building 5G networks, overwhelmingly a member state issue. And whereas Germany may not be as much of a friend of China as it used to be, China has nonetheless bought itself or invested itself into a lot of friends it didn't used to have. For example, Greece is now reliably stand up for China in internal debates within the EU because of all the Chinese investment in Greece during the global financial crisis. And Portugal is another one. So I think the EU is trying to give itself tools to react collectively to China, but the way it is engaging with China mean that the central EU itself, the Commission and the Council, just don't have as much power here as they would if it were traditional trade issues like anti-dumping and trade defence.
And do you think that this new rhetoric that we're hearing when it comes to China, is it isolated just to China? Or do you think that this issue also symbolises a bit more defensiveness on the part of the EU when it comes to issues about broader economic openness? I'm thinking here that we are now hearing proposals about, promoting European champions, defending European value chains. You mentioned foreign direct investments and the new instrument to screen FDI coming into Europe. But there's also another part of it, which is about trying to point more sectors to be strategic and protecting them from foreign takeovers, etc. So is this more of a general defensiveness on the part of the EU on matters of economic openness?
Yes, I think it has shifted that way. I mean, I think it has shifted that way. Of course, there's always been an element of that. I'm sure we all remember, I think it was Nicolas Sarkozy's attempts to protect the French yogurt sector from foreign incursion. So there is an element of that. I think it's just overwhelmingly embedded in its relationship with China, because China is just by far the biggest and the most invasive, and of course also has a huge national security dimension, the security dimension other countries do not. So yes, of course, you can imagine these tools being used against trade with Vietnam or Korea or the US or wherever. But I think it's China very largely that has sparked this move. I don't think this move would have happened without China.
Yeah. Another issue on EU trade policy, which I've been thinking about recently, is what it is it's going to do in the next couple of years. So we've had over the years sort of an EU which has put a lot of emphasis on multilateral trade policy. It focused entirely sort of on the WTO scene for a long time. And then came this big shift towards negotiating bilaterally trade agreements with other parts of the world. That agenda has been pretty successful, and the EU has finalized agreements with quite many parts of the world. And that leads to the question, I mean, is there anything more to do on the bilateral agenda in the future? And if there isn't that much to do, what is the EU going to do then? What's going to be sort of the major planks of EU trade policy going into sort of the autumn with a new commission, a new parliament and all that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you're quite right. You know, they've now knocked off Singapore, Japan, and South Korea, of course, a fair time ago. I mean, they will undoubtedly continue doing that. And, you know, they are now starting negotiations with Australia and New Zealand. I don't think it's any coincidence that they're basically going through all the countries of the Trans-Pacific Partnership one by one and showing that even if they can't knit people together into a single sort of regional deal in the way that America was doing before Trump pulled it out, nonetheless, they can, you know, increase the footprint in Asia bit by bit, as it were. So there are negotiations, you know, going on rooted with other countries like Malaysia and Indonesia and so on. There's some problems with those, of course, because of European environmental sensitivities with regard to palm oil and so forth, and we'll see if they can overcome those. And it's always possible that the old vintage negotiations with Mercosur will finally see fruit. Though really, that's just going to rely on developments on the Mercosur side. I'm not sure that the EU can do anything. So yes, they'll continue doing that. They'll continue pushing those, and then I guess there'll be some updating of old agreements that will have to go on at some point in the way that they updated their Mexican agreements. But one thing the EU has never been very good at doing is the sort of TPP thing where you have a wider grouping, where you try and pull people into a single unit in which it is the dominant force. And I don't see really very much plan to do that. In the past, they've tried to have deals with ASEAN, which was intended to do that, but it didn't really work. So yes, the bilateral push will basically run out of large economies to do, and in some of the ones they've already started, like Australia, there's some very obvious difficulties there to do with agriculture on the one side, public procurement on the other, and so forth. So you're quite right. I suspect a lot of the attention will be diverted onto firefighting with the US and with China, and to some extent it will be quite a defensive agenda. They have negotiations, and have had for a long time negotiations open with China on an investment treaty, which also involves market opening. So it's sort of a partial trade, market access trade agreement as well, which they recently put a target date of 2020 on. I'm not sure I've actually met anyone who genuinely thinks they can get them done by 2020, but that's something that they'll be pushing. And with regard to the multilateral, you know, they can't get anything done as long as the US will be digging its heels. One thing I suspect they will do, and I've heard from quite a few of EU officials, that Trump will not be in office forever. there would undoubtedly be celebrations around the European trade circuit if he were turfed out of office at the next presidential election. Now, at that point, in a sense, they have to have an offer for the new administration, because whoever the new administration is, even if it was someone a lot more multilaterally minded, you know, like Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, they would need to say to them, look, we understand you can't go back to the system you were because there's lots of genuine concern in the US that they're being ripped off by the WTO and so forth. But here's a package of reform we could get at least to rescue the multilateral system and get it going. So I think there'll be a lot of preparatory work and a lot of trying to get other countries lined up in order to prepare that. And at the same time, of course, which is sort of the other side of the coin, the EU has been working with Japan and with the US as a trilateral group to try and put pressure on China, or come up with a model that China might want to accept to make it reform as well. So yes, I think it's certainly true there will be fewer signing ceremonies over the next 5 years. I think it's going to be a more difficult and technical and sort of hand-to-hand fighting slog than it has been over the previous five.
And do you think that's true generally for the EU as well? We have now an election coming up in, 10 days from now or so, to the European Parliament, and then we're going to have a new commission coming in at some point during the autumn or early next year. What sort of EU do you think we're going to have over the next 5 years? Is it a more politically fragmented EU, or is it an EU that perhaps starts to find a better way to navigate through all the internal, external political problems they have been confronted with over the last years?
Well, I mean, outside the trade world, of course, I don't think there's been very much progress over the last 5 years. You've seen huge issues like the Eurozone crisis, where the fire has been put out, but the building is still rickety and subject to damage. And the migration crisis, which has gone down but could easily come back again, and the EU has not got any coherent solution to that. And unfortunately, leaving the parliament aside for a moment, given the rise of people like Orban and the populism in the central and eastern Europe, and indeed in the West, because it's not just a West-East split, I find it hard to see a consensus emerging among the member states to fix those things over the last 5 years that haven't been fixed over the previous five. So I suspect the EU is going to spend quite a lot of time trying to focus on that and trying to make progress on that, and not necessarily getting very far. Now, the Parliament is a really interesting one, because this is not a particular area of my expertise, but clearly there's going to be something of a move towards the extremes, and particularly there's probably going to be a much bigger populist right type sector in the Parliament. Now, you know what that means for certain issues to do with migration and so forth. We don't really know what it means for trade, because most of the opposition to trade and trade deals so far has come from the left, not from the right. And although a lot of the rhetoric of the populist right is against globalization and people taking our jobs and so on and so forth, in practice, I'm not sure that that will necessarily transfer into a lot of trade phobia. This reminds me of being in the US when lots of the Tea Party Republicans were first elected. And there was lots of chatter about, these people were isolationists, they didn't like engaging with the rest of the world, they were going to be anti-trade and so forth. As it happened, the Tea Party caucus in Congress turned out to be one of the most reliable supporters of FTAs, and to the extent you think FTAs actually mean free trade. They didn't turn out to be the problem. So although I think if there's a more populist right, it will make certain things more difficult outside trade, the impact on trade policy, I think, is ambiguous and might actually not be that negative.
And finally, Alan, I have to apologize, but I think I need to ask a question about Brexit. I suppose you as well are sort of enormously bored by the entire issue, but nevertheless, it's important. So we have now a situation in the UK where it's becoming increasingly clear that probably it's going to be a new attempt to get the withdrawal agreement through Parliament in early June. That's most likely not going to succeed. There will be a change of leadership in the Conservative Party leading to the new Prime Minister, which makes it sort of, to me at least, abundantly clear that we will not have a UK government or a situation in Parliament by October 31st in the autumn, which will have an opinion about whether it supports the withdrawal agreement or if it has another idea of what it wants to achieve with the EU in the future in the broader context of Brexit. So I'm not going to ask you what you think is going to happen in the UK, because that's so confused right now. But what's your reading of the political situation in Europe right now? Are we talking about sort of a Europe which is getting increasingly frustrated with the UK, to the point that when we get into the autumn, they will make it clear that they're not going to let this issue hang around for another 6 months, that the EU will start to push for getting some sort of resolution which may entail actually Britain leaving without a deal?
I think that actually depends on what happens between now and October, because there are clearly more divisions within the member states than there were previously. But you know, even people who are a lot closer to this than I am, and talk to a lot more people in the process than I do, are split on whether, you know, the somewhat harder line taken by France, and indeed by the Article 50 task force, will prevail, or whether the sort of more softer pragmatism of a lot of the other member states, that let's give them some more time, will prevail. But I think it will depend essentially on what happens in the UK. So here's the thing: I don't think a new prime minister, whoever it is, right, will actually make any difference. As you could put Margaret Thatcher or Winston Churchill or Benjamin Disraeli or anyone in at this point, I don't think it would make any difference to the Conservative Party, because although Theresa May is not particularly spectacularly good politician, the party is so split that I simply don't think you could get a majority to get the withdrawal agreement through. And I think you have also seen in the Labour Party that there are sufficient numbers of people who are prepared to vote against the leadership that you won't be able to get anything through. In fact, I've sort of jokingly suggested that in the forthcoming European parliamentary elections, they should just have options within the parties, you know, so you don't just vote Labour. You vote, do I support Labour brackets Corbyn, i.e., you know, the Brexit faction of Labour, or do I support Labour brackets Keir Starmer, you know, the main faction of Labour, and so forth. So I think what they will be looking for by October is a sense of how, even if it's not done by October, if you are, this impasse is going to be resolved. And I can only see at this point the only two or three things that can happen. One is a general election, two is another referendum, and three, the least likely one, is just simply to revoke Article 50. And I think a lot of it will just depend on the judgment of that. The forthcoming European elections, if you look at it, it honestly looks as though you're going to get the new Brexit Party, Nigel Farage's party, and the Conservatives and Labour and the Lib Dems on something like 20% each, which of course resolves nothing at all, because you then have a sort of spectrum from hard leave to hard remain that's sort of balanced. So I don't think it will be seen as a decisive shift in any particular direction. Which means that, you know, I'm not sure that the Tory leadership will be forced into calling a general election by the European elections, but at some point someone will have to bite the bullet and say, this is it, we need a general election or a referendum. And I think it's that that a new Conservative leader could do. You know, that you could come in and say, right, now it's time to fight an election. And so I don't think you can necessarily expect the UK to have done all of that by October, but I don't think the member states and the Commission and so on are going to be happy if we're simply in the same complete impasse with no sense of where we're going to go by next October. If that's true, I think that will be problematic.
All right. Thanks so much, Alan. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining the podcast.
No problem. Thanks so much.